The Why Nots and the Whys by Marcy Roman. Why not? It all started because we were low on money, well, lower than usual, questioning what bill wasn't going to get paid so we could cover the rent. I was at the grocery store debating whether to spend the extra $2 a pound on organic apples, or perhaps getting you, the youngest and most vital of our trio, the organic, while your father and I risked the pesticides. But then my mind jumped to what that would mean if your parents both died from mutated cells. Stop, I told myself. Shut up now. With my mind silenced, it occurred to me as I studied the apples side by side that after months of compromising, giving up cable to keep the electricity, taking a hot shower every other day, playing the Spanish station instead of buying language CDs designed to stimulate your 5-year-old brain, this might be one compromise we didn't have to make. The only difference between the two apples as far as the cashier was concerned was that silly adhesive sticker on the side, and how easy it would be with no one looking, the store empty of customers, the one nearby employee singing along to headphones as he tossed wilted bok choy into a bin, to peel the sticker off one and swap it with the other. I thought, why not? Why not a week later when I did the same for the cucumbers and for the two versions of plums, one bright purple and bursting with juice, the other pale and hard, like the cousin from the trailer park, the one no one talks about. Why not in the aisle of bulk foods, mixing up the numbers a mistake anyone could make, and so we bought trail mix for the price of white rice, while the sunflower seeds your father had to have left the store disguised in the wrinkled overcoats of raisins. Items started to fall from shelves into my oversized purse. Travel-size shampoos and ponytail holders, tampons and lip balm, and, one rainy day, a compact umbrella to keep the rain from your face, a feeling you despise. I imagine it makes you think of other things you despise, baths and showers and the scrub of a washcloth against caramel sticky skin. But I didn't consider myself a thief. The real thieves were the big corporations who were ruining the middle class, destroying our food sources, my health with worry, your sweet, innocent chemistry smelling of strawberry toothpaste and soapy elbows. This was Darwinian self-preservation. I was David taking on Goliath's price gouging, every item pocketed a metaphoric stone. I ignored the karmic hints when the cucumbers fuzzed with mold and the plums presented the sickly smell of a missed deadline and the chapstick melted a waxy splotch in the cup holder of our overheated car, the air conditioning broken since 2 summers ago. David gave way to Icarus. Why not, I thought, at the big box store, the one that no longer bothered with sensors, a device surely worth more than the cheap cotton it guarded, as I snapped a second bra over my own, layered another T-shirt, and for you, stuffed into my cleavage, a bathing suit, yellow with green stripes, that I thought would look nice with your eyes. Handing the hangers and plastic-coated number back to the attendant, I informed her I was purchasing it all, every item a perfect fit. Under my arm, I bunched a few shirts and pants into a cotton poly decoy, which I tucked behind a mannequin as I made my escape, aglow with the dopamine rush of the newly acquired. A feeling that lasted until, one step away from the sliding glass door, a hand grabbed my shoulder from behind. The original why. The thing is, I should have known better. I had, as the police would have noted if they could access my juvenile history, a prior. Not that it was written anywhere except on your grandparents' disappointed faces. Their thoughts back then communicated as clearly as if subtitles scrolled beneath their frowns. The sacrifices made, the opportunities provided, and this, the repayment? I get it now. Really, I do. The toil and effort it must have taken for a hardware store manager and a second grade teacher to build a ladder for their only child. Especially now as your dad and I struggle to construct for you a version of the American ideal glossed from magazine pages and billboards and the never-ending internet pop-up ads. He strings together clients while I bring in what I can as a part-time secretary, or, as it states on my pay stub, executive assistant, which to me is no different than renaming a plumber, a purveyor of pipes, or a waitress food support manager. It still clogged toilets and greasy dishes. A title doesn't make the tasks any less mind-numbingly dull. Once upon a time, I thought I'd have a career, but the hours for a career stretch past both sides of your needs, and your needs must be met. I do wonder how it is that your dad and I, college educated, speaking flat-footed Midwestern vowels, can do no better than a two-bedroom unit in a crumbling building with scruff for a yard. It was the best we could afford in this school district, the school district, so we make do, even though the tub leaks, the floor creaks, the washer is always eating our quarters, and the radiators groan like they're being operated by chained prisoners. It's the magical symphony of heat, I told you, when you cried at the sound. And then I sang along to it, a silly tune about hamsters and pigeons, because they always make you laugh. My point is, it would be a miracle now for people like my parents, the children of immigrants, to afford the lifestyle I had been granted. The tree-lined street, the split-level house with wall-to-wall carpeting, a partially finished basement, and, in the driveway, a used Toyota Camry, because by then it was okay to buy foreign cars. My parents believed that transferring me into the bubble of lawnmowers and joggers and red and blue mailboxes would give me a boost. Really, it was a seat in the bleachers, offering a more sanitized view than the high-rise tenement we'd come from, with its garbage and concrete and broken glass, and, as my mother declared, never a moment of peace. At least there we'd blended in. In our new neighborhood, I blemished the well-manicured landscape in my overwashed T-shirts and grubby shorts, surrounded by brighter, shinier objects. It was like getting access to Disneyland, but not being allowed to board any rides. Our neighbors, the Clarks and the Johnsons and the Reeds, had swimming pools and 4th of July barbecues. They had Christmas trees, roof lines flashing with colored strands of light. Our house was naked, except scotch tape to the door, one school-made construction paper snowflake. When I was invited into someone's home to help Kelly Johnson with algebra or when Ashley Clark put on one of her tiara dance shows, I paid attention. I saw how the world was for them, how it wasn't for me. It wasn't brand new wardrobes at the start of each school year, winter trips to sunny beaches, music lessons and sleepover camps, or even just cable TV. Our house on Elm was a facade. Closed shutters masked the used furniture and generic shampoo. The kitchen cabinets stocked with sale items still wearing their orange clearance stickers. The towels rubbed down to the thinness of sheets. I may have complained. Once, maybe twice, asking why we couldn't have nicer things like vacations and swimming pools and the shampoo with the pretty girl tossing her hair in the ad. The one who looked nothing like me. I'd already forgotten that outside our sheltered enclave, many had less, far less. Those few times I complained, my father shrugged and said, "Life isn't always fair," his stock response. The thing was, I didn't need all of life to be fair, just a reasonably sized piece of it. At school, all I wanted was not to be the object circled in the which of these is not like the other game. My hair too dark, my nose too large, my bones too big. Group the rest with their willowy limbs, their pale pink lips, their tiny, delicate noses. The voices of the other girls never warbled like mine did when called on in French class. They knew they owned their right to be heard in any language. So I stole. Gum and candy at Rite Aid, pencils and notepads and googly-eyed stickers from Bernstein's. How I loved Bernstein's, with its smell of hand soaps and plastic-sheathed office supplies and grilled cheese from the lunch counter. A balloon-lined card section that cheered with its pastel garden of good wishes. The bottom drawer of my dresser became the hiding spot for my contraband. A blue rain jacket laid on top served as camouflage. Opening the drawer and rifling the contents gave me a feeling of safety that I didn't get anywhere else. The smell of plastic on my fingers, a force field against an uncaring world. Sure, I still felt ignored, but it didn't hurt as much. I never used the items, never wrote in the notebooks or slipped the supplies from their wrapping. Only at bedtime did I eat the candy, letting a piece melt in my mouth before I fell asleep while imagining the dentist's dismay. But the drawer was a terrible hiding spot. When my mother found my stash, she made me throw it all away. Why? I demanded. A foot stomp for punctuation, but the silent movie version, socked foot into carpet. Outside I may have been invisible, but when placed in a proper ecosystem, shag, particle board, burnt toast, the scurrying girl located her cape and her voice. Why? I asked again. My mother, lips pursed, shook her head. It's wrong. She pushed the items into a plastic shopping bag, the stickers and gel pens and the pair of shoelaces with marching alligators and the blank page notebooks and, by accident, the rain jacket.
I knew the items had to go, and her discovery took away their protective magic. They were junk. Empty plastic calories. But she didn't answer my actual questions, the ones I'd compressed into that single word. Why did I feel less worthy than everyone else? Why did I feel like I didn't count? She'd thrown away the stolen goods, but not that feeling. Ma'am, the voice connected to the hand on my shoulder spoke. You'll need to come with us.
Second degree why. Did you wonder where I was those weeks when Dad had to take you to preschool? Why he yelled while I said, I'm sorry, never again, I'm so sorry. Why I dressed in jeans and long-sleeved shirts even though the temperatures were in the 90s. Why I came home with scratched hands and a sunburned forehead and put heating pads on my shoulders and fell asleep in your bed during our 5 minutes of nighttime cuddles. A stay-out-of-jail card, the judge called it, an opportunity to think and repent. I didn't tell him that I don't subscribe to any kind of religious ideology, or that I didn't feel remorse about anything except getting caught. I'm not proud of it, but I'm guessing you'd understand. The purple crayon on the kitchen floor, the broken picture frame even though you've been told how many times indoor ball playing is not allowed, the potion you made in the tub which depleted us of every medical remedy we had so diligently stocked up on, lest you come in contact with a bee, a rash, a fever, a stomach ache, an infectious wound that would not heal. Sorry, you said, toe-pointed, eyes downcast, that adorable jut of your lower lip, as behind you the tub bubbled in reds and browns, white talc dotting the top as if dusted with powdered sugar. What you meant, of course, was that you were sorry to be connected to the crime. I did not stay angry for long, even though, as you put it, my face was in mean mommy position. But in the same way that you had to drain and clean the tub, saving fish all over the city from hemorrhoids and muscle aches, I had to pay for my misdeeds. And pay I did, in hard labor and sweat and as the object of curious stares from drivers who whizzed by in air-conditioned contentment on their way to equally air-conditioned places. My task, along with my group of fellow deviants, was to clear a 2-mile stretch of highway from rubbish and Aliara petiola, a hardy invasive weed, more commonly known by its street name, garlic mustard. On the first day, 8 of us met at the designated spot, loaded into a van, stopped, cleared, loaded, stopped, cleared. I was one of 2 women. The other, Shelley, somewhere in her early 20s, was a fragile bird with limbs so thin that she looked like she'd been put together with toothpicks. I sat with her on the van ride. She wove her hair into a braid. She told me that it had all been a mistake. One terrible misunderstanding. On a trip to a department store to buy a present for her mother, she accidentally left with a bottle of Chanel and a $200 Italian purse. She told me this with so much conviction, I believed that she believed her own alternate truth. When she asked about me, I told her second-degree assault. She left me alone after that. I liked to work near a man named Charles. His arms were tattooed to look like shirt sleeves. His muscles barely contracted as he plucked the weeds, the same ones I had to grab on with 2 hands using all my weight, hoping I wouldn't plop on my rear like a character in one of your cartoons. If that happened, he'd laugh this big laugh, like wind coming up through an underground cave, and offer his hand to pull me up. Maybe if I was lucky, he'd even pull the weed for me. He called me Little Lady, which on any other occasion would bug me. Whenever I could, I'd find a spot near his broad shadow. The other men were not nearly so engaging. We started to get chatty, Charles and I, and one day he told me that he'd been pulled over for driving on an expired license plate. That had happened to me, too, once. I told him how, after I promised to get it fixed right away, the officer sent me off with a "have a good day," and how, as if he'd bestowed those words with a magical wand, my day became one in all its ticketless glory. I told Charles maybe his officer had something personal going on that made him less lenient. Charles gave that big old laugh and pointed to his face. This is what's going on. Just glad they didn't haul my black ass to jail. I heard my father utter, "Life isn't always fair." Well, I picked up my garbage bag and went in search of trash. I found plenty. Cans, bottles, broken and intact. Condoms, same. Food wrappers picked clean. Fast food bags transformed into science experiments. More bottles, plastic jugs, a chair leg, bits of metal and cloth. In a single tennis shoe, the laces gone, the rubber gaping from the heel.
I remembered how we'd lost your shoe once, a little blue slip-on with a pink flower on the toe, and how I'd retraced our steps and found it in the middle of an intersection waiting to be rescued. I knew no one was coming back to find this other shoe. That made me sad, and I left it for someone else to pick up. After I'd filled a bag, I brought it to the flatbed truck behind the van. When I tried to haul it in, I couldn't do it. I tried again, but my shoulders had locked in revolt. "Hey, little lady, looks like you need a hand." Charles picked up the bag and set it on the pile as if it were filled with nothing but crumpled tissues. When I thanked him, he shrugged. "Just offering up the gifts I've been given." Later, I saw Shelley swing hers with a force greater than her body weight. I half expected her to go flying in behind it. In the battle between will and strength, sometimes will wins out, aided by velocity. To find the velocity of a moving object, you divide the change in position by the change in time. It's one of those things I'd learned in school that stuck. You want to know something else that stuck? Me. Stranded, quite literally, on the side of the road, wondering how this experience was adding to my change over time, from daughter to wife to mother to part-time executive assistant, and now criminal, now dues-paying member of the modern-day equivalent of a chain gang. We weren't chained, of course, merely identified by our bright orange work vests. When I was told at the arraignment that I would be assigned to community service, I assumed I'd be helping children learn to read or filling a food pantry. Instead, I got beautification detail. None of the other men said to me like they said to Shelley, "Hey, doll, just having you here makes things beautiful." But Charles was the beautiful one. It was just a fact. Big and strong and confident, he always smiled and said, "Thank you most kindly," when the guards passed water around. They liked him, too, his hard-working charm, and they were always slipping him extras, bags of chips, a candy bar. They weren't bad, the guards. Only when someone wasn't pulling their weight, ha-ha, did the guards act guard-like. "Move it, Swanson," one might call through the window of the truck. And Swanson, a middle-aged white guy with a shaved head and squinty eyes, would turn up his effort one notch. Charles lived on the south side in one of those neighborhoods that's always on the news. He whistled and laughed and had seen things I could not even imagine. He always kept his effort at 11. Toward the end of the first week, I fell asleep in the car after I'd parked in front of our building. The key was still in the ignition. Your dad found me and helped me hobble up the walk, all the while admonishing me. He told me it was my own fault, that I had no self-respect. Although really, he's not much better than a thief, collecting into his bottom drawer all that information, the websites people visit, the purchases made, and then passing it along to clients who can use it to sell, sell, sell. But I know he said those things because he feels guilty. He thinks it's his fault for not bringing in enough work. He thinks he's let us down, even though I never expected him to be a trampoline. I never thought it was his responsibility to provide us with wings. On the next to the last day of our assignment, Charles didn't show up. I asked the guards where he was, and they wouldn't say. I wondered if he'd been released early. I wondered if he'd committed a crime. I worried neither was true, and he had instead become the victim. Shelley was whining that day about being tired. She had circles under her eyes, and her arms were covered with jagged scratches, and she refused to wear long sleeves. My hands tugged a resistant weed. "Don't you know that we have it so easy," I said through gritted teeth. "Don't you know to enjoy the gifts you've been given?" I pulled and pulled at the weed, hoping my will would be enough to set it free. The why now. So why am I telling you this? Whispering these secrets while you sleep, even though I know were you awake, it would still be beyond your comprehension. Icarus is not covered on the kindergarten curriculum, although Elmo and SpongeBob have been. Maybe it's because I can't remember the day you said your first word, but I remember the first time you pointed to a TV commercial, enthralled, and how the next day you grabbed off a grocery shelf the same box of sugared cereal. I put it back. I told you your dad would say it was a waste of money, even though we both know he wishes he could give in to all your terrible demands. It's the reason I can't keep the secret tucked under a raincoat. I've seen the patterns forming. I saw it at the playground the other day when, in your gray second-hand boots, you trotted after the blonde girl whose yellow boots still smelled of the rubber tree that birthed them, the girl who never looked your way. Clearly, she didn't see in you what I do, your full range of color, how you laugh in blues and pinks, Gold star-shined arms swinging from your pale green dress. Another item purchased from the second-hand store, but new, with tags attached. A find. And then, on that misguided trip to the mall, I watched your color drip into a puddle on the floor after you spotted the doll, the one that comes with its own store, and you tugged my arm and shrieked, "That one, Mama, that one, because it looks like me." And I thought, yes, it looks like you. If you had fair skin and a tiny button nose and cold, plastic, unfeeling eyes. The hair, it was brown, that was all. But even if I dug through the bottom of my oversized purse, I would not be able to gather enough coins, not even enough for the tiny dog seated obediently at the girl doll's feet. And I had to say no, not now, not later. I saw your face crumple, your glow fade, a lightning bug doused with disappointment. Do you remember the street fair last summer? The one with the musician who made you laugh? How he tossed trinkets into the crowd, plastic beads and sunglasses and pink feathered boas perfectly child-sized. You and the other children greedy gathered them up, draping, twisting, stuffing cheap metal rings onto chubby fingers. "Mama, aren't I pretty?" you demanded, bejeweled in all your fake finery. I took a photo and smiled and said, "You are dazzling," as the sun flared overhead, your own personal spotlight. What will you think of years from now when you see that photo, after your bones grow big like mine and your skin never turns fair and you can't get your hair to lie flat and no one throws jewels from a stage, certainly not the adult ones, the cars and houses and vacation cruises with bikini-clad selfies? How do I convince you that you matter and those things, those hustled jewels, aren't what make you shine? As you walked past the store, brokenhearted, you paused for one lingering glance at that doll with the brown hair and permanent smile and the wardrobe full of glorious matching outfits, all to be purchased separately. I saw the longing be born. I saw how it entered through your eye sockets before I could swipe it away. Your face stayed crumpled at dinner, and even though we had pizza, and even though I let you watch an extra show on TV, and even though I gave you 10 minutes of back scratches, I could picture it burrowing deeper, this angry, strident want. I knew that it would fester and seep into the cracks behind your knees and into your shoulder blades and into your heart until it has taken over all of you. I knew it would make you do things you shouldn't, to want the things that don't matter, gel pens and cheap jewels and that overpriced doll with the perfect complexion and soulless eyes. I want to exorcise that demon. I want to return to you your glow. And so I think, why? I think, why not? I tell myself just one more time.